Hey, Dave, this is Marconi. How are you?
Hey, Marconi. Are you for the Marconi Awards?
I am playing the Mamba and listening to the radio right now.
It's Shane McGoquin!
Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford.
The Rudy Sargent.
Hey there, this is Steve Hackett.
Hey, folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph, and we're talking rock with Dave and Shane.
Hey, Martin.
Hello, Shane. Is that Shane?
Yes, Martin. How you doing?
I'm good, Shane. You sound like you're on the moon, screaming there.
Really? I sound like I'm on the moon?
Shane is the man in the moon on a Friday.
Oh, I know. I just heard, hey!
Especially coming out of COVID, I can only imagine all the bands. You know, we've talked to, right, Shane, so many groups that were itching to get back into the studio together, especially, you know, in the age of emailing, you know, tracks and stuff. And it's like, there's nothing like playing with other people, you know, even all the times you mess up. It's just like, it's a bonding experience. Like you said, Martin, it's a bonding experience. It really is.
It is. It's a human thing. It's a ritual. It's like you us talking on the phone today to each other. You know, it's a human connection, and we don't know what we're going to say to each other. We're vibing off of each other. We're vibing. And the word vibe, you know, and groove, that's a human element. It's a ritual. You know, it goes right back to the beginning of time. People wanted to come together and sing together. It's a ritual. It's a human thing. And yet, a lot of the music, I can see, you know, talking to you now, you know, when Brian and I came into LA and everybody was interested in us because we were new technology and we were using some claviers and drum machines, we still tried to involve live playing around some of the elements of new sounds. It still felt important to us. It still felt like you don't just want to have it all be cosmetic. We still need to sing well. We still need to play some live bass on these tracks. And I could see why people were scared of us then, because when we came in to LA in the 80s, there were like the Joni Mitchells and the Eagles and Crosby, Stills, very, very on their, very nervous that this new music from England, this new, you know, the new wave was coming in. I could see them having trepidation of us because the acoustic guitars were not being used as much. It wasn't quite as hip. But it's got worse and worse and worse over time. That, you know, it's become down to really, like we say, not many people together feeling something. You know, when I recently watched again, it's one of my favorite films of the Let It Be, you know, with the Beatles, you can see them working up the songs together, even though it was a tough time for them. And when they start when Paul McCartney starts on Get Back, you can see that it's a human thing, you know, and that's where you get emotion from. It's hard for young kids to really, I think they hear it, you know, like my drummer's kids, they hear something by, say, as we just said, Led Zeppelin, and they're like, that's amazing. You know, why does that sound so different to us? And so you hope that there is a kind of, I suppose, reformation, that people go back a little bit and go, we still want to use the net new technology, but we don't want to lose the wonderful magic of humans, a group, vibing together, because sometimes that music is, I think that's still why people like in general live music, although a lot of it is now, you know, singing to auto tune on stage.
Right.
But there's still that sense that they're coming together to see something that's unique, and I hope that comes into the music in the future more.
With going back to that early 80s sound, one of the bands I really, really love and fell in love with as a kid, obviously, was Gary Numan through the single Cars. And he always had regular drums. You know, he had a drummer, and it had such a neat sound because you had the synth up against the drums like that. I wish that sound, I love that sound. I love that feel instead of just, you know, the drum machine gone
That's a real thing. It's a real thing. And we were aware of that, myself and my partner in the 80s. We were very aware of that because even when Earth, Wind & Fire, we're going to do my song Magnetic, which was the demo is all me with keyboards and drum machines. when we went in with Earth, Wind & Fire to do it, Maurice White played live drums. And we were, and Maurice and Verdine wanted to play live bass, even though I'd sequenced the bass. We were very aware, as you say there, Shane, that Thompson Twins had live players. Tom Dolby had live players. We were very aware that the synthesizer and Ultravox, you know, live drummer, it was very, a tremendous sound to have a live playing with synthesizers and some technology. There's a real magic there because that's a really good blend and it's interesting. And so we were very aware that even though we were using synthesizers to excite people when we wrote songs, we would also be saying, well, we're going to put some guitar on this and we're going to have a live drummer and some percussion because we need to rough this up and we need to feel like there are actual humans in the room with this new technology. So I agree with you. There are some incredible records made around the 80s, which were thought of as new wave that had a lot of live playing on them. Even, you know, Duran Duran, you would find that there would be a mixture of live bass playing. ABC, you know, and Trevor Horn was also very skillful, and Peter Gabriel is a tremendous example of using, you know, the Fairlight and the Synclavier and new technology mixed with emotional players and old world players. I think then you've got a very magical music between new technology and real humans dealing with it. That, I think the 80s had some great records like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's. I think what's so amazing is to me, the process. Like I learned more and more about the production process. Now, I don't mean so much now with Pro Tools, but like even how records, you know, in the 80s were done. Like when did digital first come? Was it like 84 when digital recording kind of started up? You know.
Well, that's a very good point. When we were recording around 84, 85, the Sony digital multi-track machine started to come into the picture. And some people were experimenting with it then. It still had its problems. But you're right. Most of us were working on Studer 24-track, 2-inch tape. And then the Mitsubishi and the Sony 32-track digital machine started to appear here and there. And then the Synclavier digital keyboard came into the studios, and that was also a way of recording and sampling instruments digitally. And then there was the little ADAT tape machine that you could buy very cheaply to record your songs on, 8-track ADAT, and that was a form of digital as well. And then in came the DAT machines, I think 85, 86, the DAT machines came in, and we were all sort of fascinated that we didn't have to record our mixes down to cassettes. We could put them onto DATs, and they were digital, and they supposedly lasted longer. And then I think around that period, the CD came out, and we were all like, Bruce Hornsby's first record was on CD, and none of us stopped playing it. And Dire Straits' record came out on CD, and it was such big news that you'd go into a studio, and somebody would play to you, you know, Dire Straits' album on CD, and we all go, I think that's better and clearer, and there's no hiss. And now we love the hiss. We go looking for hiss now, you know.
Yeah.
You even buy software on Pro Tools to put tape machine hiss into your recordings. That's how bad it's.
That's right.
And if we're doing a vocal, we say, leave the door open outside so we can get some hiss coming into the studio. We need
that's so funny.
To pour the kettle.
that's the warmth.
So
it
warms down in the circle. Yeah.
That's the warmth that you speak
of. We think of that era as an authentic era now, yet when we were coming out of the 80s, like you mentioned, digital was making its way into the studios. And everybody wanted everything to be so clean and precise and bright. And now there's, if you're working on Pro Tools, you're putting in software which makes it sound like old tape machines and old microphones. And we're trying to get back, it seems, slightly to having more authentic vintage sound, you know.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the,
because we kind of beat around this almost, because you did talk a lot around this. What are your thoughts on tracks? I mean, because you worked your butt off and you wanted to play stuff live. You wanted to be moving your hands. You wanted to be. What are your thoughts on tracks being used in a lot of live performances? Because fans want the real thing now. They don't want tapes and tracks used for like Motley Crue has been really slammed a lot over the past year for using allegedly using bass tracks and guitar tracks and vocal tracks. Are you one of those people? Do you say if you got it, use it, or do you say?
The word there again. I think saying it's balance again. You know, it's a matter. It's lovely to hear the lead singer singing, or you know, normal and fighting for the. I believe in that. I mean, when I took the House of Stone and Light tour out, we played everything live except for we had when some of the songs had a huge amount of vocals on them. We'd bounce down on a few of the backing tracks of like a choir, and we would use that the same way Peter Gabriel now on tour would maybe use, you know, beginning of Sledgehammer. You'll hear some samples being used. So we'd have a keyboard player sometimes play a few sounds that we just could not perform live, but it was a real balance. You know, it was important that even if we had slight rhythms being played by a drum machine that was on the record, we'd have my drummer with headphones on, as he would be in the studio playing to some percussive part. So I think it's a mixture. I think when you see a band or, you know, a performer come out and they're singing through auto-tune and it's not all their vocals, I think that's worrying and not as exciting. I think we want to see singers go for it, not always be in tune. That's a human element, and to fight for things. And I think we want players to play. I mean, that's the word live. But I don't think it's bad to have elements that are hard to achieve live, but were done in the studio, a minimal amount of those. For instance, when Queen went out, you know, and they had to do Bohemian Rhapsody, they would have some samples of those incredible harmonies that they couldn't all get with without overdubs. So I think I think you need a mixture of both. Certainly, 70% should be live, and maybe the 30% of what is pre-recorded has to be things that just can't be done again. I don't think it's great to see a singer come out and say he's miming and he's singing through auto-tune all the time. I find that disconcerting. That's how I feel about it. But I don't think it's bad to have elements that you achieved in the studio that are integral to the record. And, the, you know, like Sledgehammer is like, on the front, it's kind of an unusual pan pipe sound. And the keyboard player just pushes down a note and they've got that. I think that's okay. We know that Peter Gabriel and the band will be playing everything else around that. But I think it's a balance is needed. I think the vocals have to be live. You know, I think vocals... That's really why you're going to see it. You want to see the singer do his thing and believe in him and believe in their communication, you know. So that's how I feel about it. I can imagine, I don't know the story of Motley Crue, but I mean, if most of the music and some of the vocals aren't you, I could see the audience becoming like, I could have played this at home in my bedroom, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's better in my bedroom than this, you know.
Right. Yeah, we were, it's funny because this is like the topic, you know, you get a blabbermouth on some of these websites and it's like every artist weighs in, and like Wolfgang Van Halen was saying, like, you know, sometimes you got a sample, and even Eddie Van Halen would say, like, on Right Now, you know, they obviously would play the sample, he would say, you know, I'm not against sequencing, but as long as it's me playing it, you know, you know, he's obviously going to play the guitar parts live, or did play the guitar parts live while they're, you know, the track was playing the piano for something like Right Now. And I think his son was even saying, you know, like, you still got to be able to play the meat and potatoes of it, the drums, the guitars, you know. But what was it? Shane, who was it? It was Graham Bonnet who was saying, like, in their band, they have one guitar player, so they have to use, like, tracks for, say, rhythm guitar because they don't have a guitar player. So I get that, but, you know, I guess it's, you know, like, there's, you know, there's exceptions, I guess,
Yeah, I think it's a balance, and I think, you know, when as you brought up earlier about, you know, songs that you sing on and instrumentals, I think if there's a singer in the band, and he should be singing the stuff, you know. But if there's a few background vocals of a choir that was integral to that record, or as you say, a rhythm part, there's nothing wrong with that, because the audience wants to feel like they're hearing the best they can. But in general, you've got to lean 75-80% towards saying, we're going out on the road. We're supposed to be human and alive here. Let's not just, we could not turn up and just leave a computer on the stage and just push a button and they'll walk away. No, the element of live is the word live. You've got to perform, whether it's good or bad. I think Bon Jovi went out a few years back, and they were just killing him because of his vocals. He couldn't hit a lot of the notes. But, you know, all credit to him. He went to perform. He's alive. He's trying to do his best, and people fell in love with it. And ultimately, none of us as we get into our later years can sing at the range that we're used to. But if they're going out and you're moving the keys down a little bit to help you, and you're still performing with soul and heart, well, good on you. That's what it's all about.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of live.
I was gonna say, that's what keeps you young too, is that soul aspect of it. You know, like, music doesn't have an age. You know, like, that's that part.
Yeah.
That, sorry, Shane. I didn't mean it.
No. Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, and I nearly became a professional soccer player, but I loved music, and I thought, well, with music, you can go on, you know, till you're in a wheelchair, you can go on. But if you're a professional football player, it's over within 22, you know, years. 23. Something about music and art. Here we are all talking today about it. It keeps us young. It keeps us alive. It keeps us fascinated and keeps the curiosity there. And it really is magical. We don't know what we're going to compose. If we knew what it was, we wouldn't be doing it. It's a magical unknown process. For me as a songwriter, when I do sit down. And I'm thankful. I'm still prolific, and I haven't ever had writer's block. I do find that I'm a little turned on, because I don't know what I'm going to do. I've got an idea. I've got a certain amount of skill that I can use, but I don't know really what's going to come out of me. And it might be really quite special, and it might a lot of people might like it. So there is something about that I think, in the words of keeping us young. You know, if I pass the mirror, I go, "Fuck me, no, you're not young." But when you
think, you look quite young. I was going to say, what is your secret?
Yeah.
It must be the tea. I know you're a tea drinker. That's right.
So maybe always the tea.
I am. I'm sat here with a cup of tea now, and Thai food tea does good. And I'm one of the luckiest things in the world, lads. You know, I'm doing what I still love. You know, if somebody was to say to me, in your 60s, people still want to talk to you about some of the songs you've written, and I've still got, I'm about to do some more work today on another album, I think I would be the luckiest man in the world. So I do think I chose a job, a career, that I'm lucky. It's looked after me. But I do think when it's a career of creativity, there's a little bit of magic in there, where you're not sure exactly what you're going to do. You're not in a factory being told what to do. I do think it helps. I do think it's a choice of what you do in your life. And I do think I'm lucky, because halfway through my career, I sort of realized I was working very hard, and I stopped and studied Buddhism. And so I meditate. And in fact, my first album, In the House of Stone and Light, was really about that, about really, you know, changing my lifestyle, because I was really a studio dog. And I was able to sort of step back a little bit and take it a little bit slower. And I think that I've been lucky that way. You know, I still get excited about, as we just talked about, you know, Jupiter 8. I still get excited about, I mean, my partner in my band 40 years ago, he lives around the corner, so we still meet up. And my drummer from my first band lives in Burbank, and so the three of us sometimes get together. And it's quite phenomenal that we think we've been doing music all our lives, and we've luckily not been torn down by drugs or alcohol or the wrong things. You know, we've all been tempted, and we've all taken steps in that direction. But the ones that come out the end of that and still see music as the gift, then I feel very fortunate. You know, my back goes out quite a bit, because I'm a big, tall lad, and I play bass and I hunch over, but you know, that's better than being in a factory and you know, smoking, getting smoke in your lungs and whatever, and not feeling that you're being creative. I mean, you guys are creative on this show. There's something that is very spiritual about that and healthy. Creativity and curiosity is something that makes us, I think, look forward to the days we get up.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So that's my story anyway.
No, I agree.
Oh, I was reading that from a book. I thought, that sounds good.
What's the book? No.
Yeah.
What a musician should say on a podcast. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Volume one, yeah.
I know you're a fan of this era because we talked about it before, and I'm a huge fan of it too, but how cool is it to see bands like New Order, Tears for Fears, OMD, Duran Duran, all those early 80s bands, the real bands that they're playing a festival in Huntington Beach in November. It's like 30 some bands, Darker Waves Festival. Everybody's going to be there. Violent Femmes, Echo and the Blamen. It's sold out. How does that make you feel to know that generation, something you were a part of and still a part of, is so successful and still desirable?
Yeah, it is interesting because even when I do my little songwriter podcast, you know, when I say I'm going to play a track from the 80s, I get a lot of response about that. There seems to be a love for the 80s period. You're right. And one of my best friends is Jack Hughes from Wang Chung, and I see him nearly every year because he comes across doing a tour. I think he's here again in LA in September. And on an album that I hope to put out at the end of the year, he was playing on it a couple of years back when I was piecing it all together. And there's a great demand for the 80s. I feel quite proud about it because I realized that it was a time in music that I was very fortunately part of. I came out of the 60s, luckily, with being influenced by the Beatles and Motown music, and then becoming a musician in the 70s when everybody wanted to play. So I became a bass player, a musician in the 70s, sort of all the bands, Average White Band, Doobie Brothers, everybody played.
Oh, man.
And that was a great time. And so I became a bass player. Mm-hmm. And then I became more of a songwriter and arranger in the 80s. And that's when technology sort of really became a revolution with the way people recorded music. So I feel very, very fortunate that I was a child, in a way, of those three periods. I had a lot of success in the 90s. And my own success as an artist was in the House of Stone and Light in the 90s. And that period hasn't really resonated with people as much. We sort of went back to being players. I was working with Robbie Robertson on his album, and my album in the House of Stone and Light was very much not so much drum machines or synthesizers as much as live playing integrated with sort of primal work and spiritual work. And we had a lot of artists in the 90s like R.E.M., and everything, and that period doesn't resonate quite as much as the 80s does. I think the 80s is Technicolor. I was recently interviewed for a documentary on We Built This City, and I'd say the 80s was very colorful. It was very much a Technicolor period. If you were in LA and you put on the radio and you got K-Rock, you were hearing music that was revolutionary, very, very uplifting, very sparky. It was very exciting, and I think people now look back at that 80s period as a bright period, and a lot of that music still is important music. If we look at the Human League, the album Dare, it's a phenomenal record, and if we look at what Duran Duran did, you know, on a few albums, they did some very revolutionary music, and we look at even with American bands that were breaking through that time, you know, we're Talking Heads and Missing Persons, and Oingo Boingo. Very, very, very Technicolor period. And I think we're nostalgic still for that period. And but I'm proud that my breakthrough came through in that period. I feel very lucky that I was on form in that period. I was writing a lot of songs from We Built the City, These Dreams. Stuff for Starship, Stuff for the Earth, Wind & Fire. A lot of my songs have been taken, and I was very much in touch with what the 80s aesthetic was. I really understood it. I don't understand it quite as much now because you change over the years, but I was like a sportsman. I was in the team at the right time. I really understood what needed to be done. I was on form in that period. I couldn't do much wrong because I understood the aesthetic of the 80s and what it when I wrote for Go West, you know, King of Wishful Thinking and Faithful, I even though that was coming into the 90s, I knew what that 80s had done to us, and I knew what the color was for hit records at that point, which was, I was very lucky. I was on form at the right time.
Speaking of, you know, the 80s, I always wondered, I knew what I wanted to ask you was, what did you think of the music video that Earth, Wind & Fire did for Magnetic? Somebody said it looked like Star Wars meets Soul Train. I love that video. I love that. Yeah. It's amazing. It's an amazing track. You did an amazing job on it. And the video was just wild. It was unlike anything
yeah,
any day I've ever
done. Yeah, you know, for Earth, Wind & Fire to be in Blade Runner was a very strange feeling. We went to the building in LA. I mean, I went down there that night to see them doing it because it was a big breakthrough for me to have Earth, Wind & Fire cut one of my songs and it to be their first thing off Electric Universe. Maurice was wanting to change their sound. He was ahead of his time, and he said, we're going to have to change. After their Powerlight album, the fans were dropping off, and he didn't want to use horns. He wanted the new technology. He heard my song Dancing in Heaven on K-Rock, and he was interested in that sound, and he liked Tom Dolby's Blinded by Science. So I had an interview with him, and we really hit it off. He's in the UFOs, and my father worked for British Aerospace, and my dad knew the pilots that had seen UFOs. So the moment I said UFOs exist to Maurice, I was in the band. I was so good. I was allowed through the door, and he said, go away and write a song that is in that capacity. And I wrote Magnetic, which was very different for them. But yeah, they went down and did this video, and I was surprised. You know, I mean, it was like Blade Runner. And over the years, it's, you know, at first, I mean, it didn't do. I think it got top 10 R&B, but in the pop charts, I think it just went top 40. And Earth, Wind & Fire were a little bit on a decline at that time, but. The video over the years has become sort of quite famous in its own way. And it's unusual for them to be in that kind of, they were trying to take a leap from the 70s into the 80s. And so it can be quite comical and quite hard for a lot of their fans to say, oh my God, they've suddenly, you know, changed and they're in Blade Runner. What's going on? And there's lasers and all sorts of things. But it was something they had to do, and Maurice White was very experimental. He was a mentor to me through that time, and he wanted to change his sound. Even though I was saying, I'd like to have some real horns, he was, no, we're going to do this with synthesizers. So he was, but it's funny, there's a few, I've seen the Magnetic video recently, and I was expecting not to like it, you know, and go, oh dear, but I didn't. I went like, oh, I can see that's got a lot of energy, it's got a lot of power. And some people have done some edits of that video and joined it with AI video, and it's even more fantastic, you know. And my lyric, Magnetic, it's a dangerous dance. Obviously, they were trying to take it into the future, and I think Blade Runner was very much an iconic thing at that time. So, yeah, it's an unusual one for Earth, Wind & Fire, but I'm still proud of that record. They did a remaster of it recently, and the remastering of it was fantastic, and it was it sounded like the way I always imagined it. But I remember teaching Verdine White the bass, you know, on it, and I'll never forget that because he was one of my heroes as a bass player. It was unreal to be stood with him. You know, I'd been in little bands in England playing Earth, Wind & Fire songs, you know, in the pubs, and there I was in the studio with Earth, Wind & Fire teaching them one of my songs. It was unreal. I think Earth, Wind & Fire were one of the most seminal R&B bands of all time. So I'm very proud of that period.
Yeah. Huge, yeah. Huge.
Yeah, yeah. But I wasn't in that video. They didn't ask me to be in it. I wonder why. I just don't know.
Do you still keep in contact with Paul Joseph Moore and Robert Bell from Blue Nile? I remember we talked about
that. Well, that's
before.
A great – well, I just have to say, you know, I've got an album, hopefully, that I've that I feel is the best record I've made in the last 4 or 5 years, with all the players, live players, that were with me and on In the House of Stone and Light. I hope to release that around October and November. I've been on it for 5 years. It's the best album I've ever done, up with A House of Stone and Light. It's taken me a long time because it was through COVID and all the players, Jack Hughes and Paul Joseph Moore. Yes, he played keyboards on the new album I'm going to put out. I sent some of the tracks to him in Edinburgh in Scotland, and he played some amazing keyboards, so I'm in touch with him still. I had Bill Dillon, Peter Gabriel's guitarist, who also played on my House of Stone and Light album back then. He played some tracks for me in Canada. And Russell Broom also. Brian Fairweather played guitars. And I had Trevor Thornton, my drummer from my early years in Q-Phil. He played the drums. Jimmy Copley, who was Tears for Fears' drummer, he was about to play on the album, but unfortunately he passed from leukemia. There's a couple of songs on there dedicated to him because he was rehearsing them before he left us. And so it's a very, very soulful and special record that I spent a long time on because I wanted to honor the players that played with me. But yes, Paul Joseph Moore, not the other guys in the band, Paul Joseph Moore from Blue Nile speaks to me regularly and has just played on my new record. Yeah.
Wow. Any word on, we can't wait to hear that. And
I've taken this album very, very serious because the musicians have been saying to me, where is it? We played on this 3 years ago. What's going on? And I said, I've just been developing this with passion and I wanted to make it right. And, I've made an album with live players. I usually do it all myself. So this is a record I really wanted to honor their playing on. So it's finished. It's just I'm going to maybe putting it out on vinyl, CD, doing it the way we should be doing it with the right artwork and everything. So I've been very slow and pushing towards it, but I wanted to do it the proper way. So I'm more excited about this next record than I've been, for 20 years. There are some songs on here that I won't ever beat. They were written because Jimmy was suffering from cancer in England, and I was writing songs for him to lift him in the hospital in England. And his girlfriend wanted me just to keep talking to him to say that he would be able to get out, and he was having a bone marrow operation. And so the songs were written not for an album, but to get him playing with me as a rhythm section again. And then I realized when I played these songs to other people, they said there's something very special about these songs. And in fact, the guy, Jack Hughes, we were just talking about, who came to play guitar on some of the tracks, he made his next solo record from the influence of hearing these tracks he played on because he was so turned on by the songs. He said, they're the best you've written. Neil Taylor, Robbie Williams guitarist in Tears of Fears, who played on House of Stone and Light, he also dropped in to play on the record as well. So I do hope I can get it out by October and November, but it always sounds cliche because every time an artist releases something, he goes, this is the best work I've ever done. But there's something in this record that equates with the best work I did on House of Stone and Light because it wasn't written as an album. It was written for Jimmy to come back into the world. Unfortunately, it didn't lift him back and we lost him, but the spirit of those songs trying to motivate him runs right through the album, right lyrically as well, right through the record. So, I secretly believe in what I'm just about to put out.
Yeah, I mentioned this to you before, but In the House of Stone and Light, that particularly the title track is just one of my favorites, that and Keep With the Flame. I remember when that hit VH1 in the early 90s, and it was kind of funny because, back then I think MTV was doing more of the current youthful stuff, the hip-hop and some of the poppy stuff, which was fine, But VH1 was great with the more adult contemporary newer stuff. And I just remember when that hit, it was always one of my favorite songs.
Thank you, mate.
Absolutely.
It's become a bit of a perennial song. It took a long time for it to break because it was an unusual kind of song. But for 2 years, it was the most played song, mainly for adult contemporary. And as you point out there, it wasn't so much. It was the 90s, and I'd just been recording with Robbie Robertson on his first solo album, Fallen Angel and Hell's Half Acre, with Daniel Lemoir. And so I really had an understanding of the way I was going to make my first solo record, which was going to be more to do with me as a vocalist and writing songs and as an artist, not, you know, here's a songwriter who puts out, you know, songs that he writes for other people. Lots of songwriters did that. I wanted to be seen as a totally different kind of entity. And so I was very happy that House of Stone and Light came out, and nobody really thought of me as the songwriter of We Built the City or These Dreams. It had its own thing. And that was the period back then. It's funny because both of these albums, the new one I'm talking about, relates to somebody, you know, struggling with an illness. And House of Stone and Light really was me going to the Grand Canyon and trying to, you know, spiritually renew myself after many years of bad work and not looking after myself physically. So I think sometimes you write those records from another level. You know, you're not thinking, is this commercial? You're thinking, am I doing something that artistically has a little bit of length to it? You know, and as you say, the fashion, hip hop and whatever was happening, I wasn't trying to do that. I was more into just thinking, can I write some great songs that I can sing? And it's me singing them, and I'm getting my own emotions across. I think somebody wrote a review and said it's the first time I was writing ever lyrics for myself. And it's true. You know, before that, you're writing lyrics or taking Bernie Taupin's lyrics and seeing somebody else do it. But with that, as soon as House of Stone and Light came along, I was writing lyrics that were all about myself, which was a different thing.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on I know this is kind of a big question, but I figured I'll ask you. What are your thoughts on the state of the world these days? Does that come into play with your songwriting when you're making these records? And do you try to approach that with the glass as a glass half empty kind of thing or a glass half full? I know you talked about Buddhism, and it's pretty much
It's another really, really, really great question. I don't usually get answered that. And on the new album, you know, there are a couple of songs that do touch slightly on slight political edges. I'm not really a political writer because I'm not a great fan ever of politics. And I think that becomes very fashionable and passes really quick, and you can look a real idiot when you make a statement that you don't really know too much about. But obviously, wars in Ukraine and Russia, they encroach into what I do. I released a song about a year ago called Endure, and that was really about, you know, what we all seem to have to go through continually when countries go to war. We have to endure this period of slaughtering each other and then stopping again. It's a vicious, horrible circle. But I tend to write, more about personal aspects of humanity. I it sounds big, but I just written a song called Little Prayers, which is really about, you know, a lady during the Second World War who saved all the Jewish children in the ghetto. And was pretending that they were Christian children. And so they were taught to sing Christian prayers. And so I sometimes touch on subjects like The Door on the House of Stone and Light, which was the Treblinka concentration camp. But I always feel that the best way I can write about it is through human terms, as though I'm writing through somebody who's going through suffering. You're right, with Buddhism, you know, I do believe that we suffer a great deal as human beings. And so love songs and songs that even the House of Stone and Light is a redemption song. It's about, you know, saying I need to get my body right. That's how the Indians of the Grand Canyon called their area the House of Stone and Light. But I saw the house as my body, and I saw that I had to have strength, which was stone, and I had to reach towards the light. So I saw my body as the house of stone and light. So I see everything in my songs mainly through a quite romantic point of view, which is a personal kind of view. I always write that way. In fact, there's a song on the new album called Courage, and I know it's a title that will be used by millions, but the idea of for me, I see courage when somebody believes in love. If somebody takes love as their law, I see that as a courage. You know, you when love dominates something, and not in a romantic way, but saying, I see courage when I see love in somebody that wants to dedicate themselves to even saving an animal or doing something through the eyes of love. I think that's courage. I've always written songs that lean that way. Politically, and the way the world is at the moment, I mean, the terrible situation we're facing with global warming, that's a reality which is coming to face us head on. I'm aware of it all, but I think as a songwriter, for me, I feel like if you can write from a personal point of view as a human, then all those messages about war, global warming, love, hate, pain, death, and I write a lot about death. I think that the political messages come through in that way. I think they come through in an easier way without telling somebody what they should do or how they should be. But again, as you point out, because I take Buddhism seriously and it helped me, the Four Noble Truths, I think that most humans, even us talking today, we're suffering. We go through, you know, we all sound informed. That's our masks. But behind that, you know, we know we're all going to die. And we know that we're dealing with people that are ill or struggling. So I think that music is one of those places to make us very aware of being lifted up, even told some truth. I don't think it's easy for me to say you should be a Republican or a Democrat. as Buddhists would say, you know, the word that we deal with is ignorance. Not an ignorance in a way that that person is just an imbecile. Ignorance that we don't know. That's really what it is. We just don't know. As a Zen priest would say, I don't know what this all is. I don't understand. And I think when anybody admits that they don't know, and particularly art does that really well, I think that's the best way I can write a song, more with simplistic point of view, because I think sometimes the simple communication of emotion lasts longer than somebody saying you should join the army. You know, I think there's something in emotion that touches people on a deeper level. So that's how I write. I've never been a political writer. I think if I tried to write politically, I would be a fool. I don't really know what I'm talking about. I just go from a human element of, of joy, love, peace, and health, and also the incredible thing, I think, as romantic poets point out, and I always look at them and I read a lot of poetry to influence the lyrics, is that understanding that we as humans know we are going to die. There's an impermanence. So I think that's what makes music and art so incredible. Because we know it's not always going to be here, and the person who's delivering it is not always going to be here. That's the human element, impermanence, and I think that's what makes music and art and expression so amazing, and makes things pertinent that we know that we're not going to be here forever. And particularly as you get older, you know, you start to go, wow, my God, you know, 10, 15 years, that's all I might have. So I better understand some of this spiritually, get this inside my bones. So that's what makes music, to me, fantastic, because I'm rambling on here, but I do find that music stops us in our tracks, and we forget that we forget that we've got pains, that we're struggling for a brief moment. It's that moment we get when we go outside of ourselves. And I find that when I'm writing music, time stands still sometimes. I'm lost, and I'm not dealing with being in a human body. It's the same with people when they see a good movie or they see a painting. Sometimes there's that moment. I think you know what I'm talking about. You are outside yourself. You become more of a spiritual element for a second or two. And that's, I think, one of the best feelings in the world. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, boy, you summed it up. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we were blessed to talk with David Crosby actually 2 months before he passed on. And you know, to listen to that interview, you know, since after he passed, it's so surreal because you're thankful that the music legacy is left, but you to know that we're never going to hear from that person live again is surreal. It really is.
Yes, I'd love to hear that interview. Yeah. I think that's what probably comes, you know, with a little bit of longevity, you know, some of those artists, we have to really respond to if they're talking like that, you know, because they've been through the eras and they've got something to give us back. I mean, Joni Mitchell, you know, still recording now. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful because they've seen it all. They've been through it all and they've got something to impart. And in general, you know, it's a funny little thing here, just to make it more levity here, is when I was a young kid thinking about what I wanted to do, I found that that musicians were all good people and songwriters were usually good people. And like you guys, doing music, talking about podcasts, in general, they were people you could get on with.
Yep.
I worked with so many musicians and so many people came to work with me. And the majority of them were good people and looking to create and spread love. I mean, it sounds corny, but you know, the greatest thing about the Beatles, as Paul McCartney says, is all their songs were about lifting up. They weren't about negativity. They were trying to encourage and preach the word about love and peace. And that's a brilliant thing. And I thought about it one day. I thought, I've worked with loads and loads of people in the studios, including musicians and engineers, people like yourself. In general, those people, in general, are good human beings. It's an interesting thought.
Yeah, agreed, yeah. And you know, they're
except
the same...
for the attorneys, of course.
Right. Oh, gosh.
They're bastards. They're all bastards.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. And the people
and
who...
And the record company, bastards.
Yeah. No doubt about that.
Yeah, wow. I just had a bead of sweat come down then, all down the
floor. Yep. He's back.
Well, Martin, this has been amazing. I mean, such a joy and a pleasure to catch up with you. I mean, you're one of our favorite people I have on the show. I think you've been on three times now. It's such a pleasure.
Is it three times?
I think so. I think it is. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, because we talked when the Poetry of Collisions Volume 1 came out, and then I think a little bit before that also, yeah.
That's brilliant. I remember Poetry of Collisions because I know you're playing some of the demos. That's great.
Yeah,
you guys
absolutely.
Are fantastic. I mean,
you too.
Know,
Thank you, sir.
We jammed today, and we talked about lots of subjects. And, of course, when the new records on the edge are coming out, which I'll be so proud about, I'll let you guys know first. Because I've been working on this.
Please do.
Yeah. But it's been a joy. It was nice just to rap about open things and just to let go. And for me to shout the word bastard out loud was very exciting to me.
Cathartic.
And that's very strange for a Buddhist to do.
I was just going to say, is that part of the Buddhist healing? Is that the
We have it on tape.
That's right.
Well, it's been great. I'm going to have another cup of tea now. But you guys keep on doing the great stuff you do.
You too, Martin. Thank you so much.
You too, Martin. Thank you, sir.
All right. I'll see you guys soon. Lots of love. Yeah.